Okay. Good. That's what are we today? We're all April 8th. By the way, if you look on the Sfarim blog today, there is an article about that by Rabbi Breuer, and someone has a comment there that I don't know about the zodiac, but apparently the moon is in the zodiac where it's supposed to be. That you can say even if you don't hold it, you don't have to say you don't say a bracha on an eclipse if you can see part of the moon. You could say the bracha. Okay. I have a lot I want to get to, but I'd like to start the regular things, regular class at 8:45. So we will get going now. I'm going to push other stuff till next class, including sushi and a number of other things. But I want to everything started piling up. Okay. I told you about this book that Rabbi Gifter sent me. Oh, hold on, I got to open up my other computer here. Rabbi Zalman Gifter from the material of his father. So this is a whole volume, by the way. Look how thick it is. A whole volume of letters between him and Rav Moshe Aaron Polayeff. Rav Moshe Aaron Polayeff was a Rebbe at YU, and the first 2 years that Rabbi Gifter was in, he was at Yeshivas Rabbi Tzolchanan. He was in the high school, not at the college. So he was in Rav Polayeff's shiur. Then at age 17, he goes to Tells. I really didn't know what an Eloi he was. He's 20 years old. He's finishing Masechtas left and right. It's pretty unbelievable. And you can't write his biography. I told this to the son, who agreed with me. Artscroll came out this biography. They didn't have access to these letters. So you really don't, you're missing the whole point. His turn against YU, that I'm very happy they censored only very, very little. Some people will be upset with this, but the stuff he says about Yeshiva College and the Teachers Institute and Rabbi Revel, the stuff he says about Rabbi Revel, but it's really interesting. But so why do I mention this? Because right at the beginning of page seven, what is he, Rabbi Polayeff writes to him, they include his grandson. His grandson is Rabbi Senter from the Chaf K. He includes Rabbi Polayeff. We have an oral memoir that he gave a whole, and he speaks a lot about Slutsk, incidentally. And, we spoke all about Slutsk. I want to show you something about Slutsk, because I think, I forget now who sent this to me, but, look, the Slutsker Rav, Rav Meir Feimer, he had a son, Yosef. I mentioned that he came to America. It turns out he was a Rav in Borough Park. Fine, there he is. But he pronounced it in America, at least Pimer. So I don't know. Maybe we should. I think Moshe sent this to me. Moshe from Lakewood. So thank you. But I'll still say Feimer because in yeshiva circles, that's what you say. You say Feimer, as far as I know. But in addition to his oral, memoir, which they then wrote up, he also wrote himself something in Hebrew, and they quote from it. And he's talking about his time in Slutsk with Rabbi Chanan, with Rabbi Yisrael Meltzer. And what does he say? He said that in discussing all the things he would do there, one of the things he stresses is Teretz Akushas Hoshen. So you see that Rav Polayeff, one of the things he remembers is that he did Ketzos HaChoshen. We saw that that's what Rav Feimer picked up on, that all these guys are doing is Ketzos HaChoshen. Look, I could spend five classes just on this book of letters. It's so insightful. One of his great friends at Yeshivas Rav Tzolchanan is a person named Eliezer Goldman, who he thinks he's an Eloi, he could be a God, all this. Eliezer Goldman then ends up leaving Yeshivas Rav Tzolchanan. He goes, I guess, to university. He's an early Zionist. He makes Aliyah very early, and he becomes a leading figure in religious Zionism. I think even the kibbutz movement, a thinker, Eliezer Goldman. Look him up if you don't know who he is. And there's like five or six letters where Gifter's first is hopeful, maybe Goldman will remain on the Torah path, and then he's slowly losing hope. And another friend as well. But I just one more thing I got to tell you about. Page 386. Really, what I was, it's not, maybe not as relevant as it was an hour ago, because I just saw that the Mir Yeshiva announced they're not stopping for Bein HaZmanim. They're going further into Bein HaZmanim. And And they're going to continue learning. Yes, I see it popped up on my screen. In fact, let me open up my chat. Moshe Shoshan is a great grandson. Simon Shoshan. There are many. He has many grandchildren. There's someone in my town. His name is Poliev. That's where we saw Poliev's son. But there's grandchildren everywhere. But so look on page 386 in this book is dated Parshas Tazria Tavshin Chet, 1948. That's during the 1948 war. And Rabbi Gifter writes to Rav Poliev as follows. He's no Zionist at all, but he's very much against the crazies who really you don't have to be a Zionist to recognize that God protects the Jewish people and there's Nisim and all that unless you're Satmar. So, but he writes that he says in his opinion. They should levatel kol inyan bein hazmanim right now during this war, 1948. And he quotes the Maharsha in Shabbos, Kufya Tesavan Beis, that the gezeros in his time, why were they? The Maharsha already mentions that problems they had because of this idea of bein hazmanim. In fact, I looked up the Maharsha. I'm holding it right here on in Shabbos. He says that he speaks about all the problems in his day. What's that? That's the early 17th century. In fact, rather than me speculate, I will tell you the exact dates of the Maharsha. 1631, he dies. 1555. Okay. Listen what he says. He says that there's, in our day, we have Isurei Shabbos. People are not careful about that, about Shabbos. He says, "B'chol motzei Shabbos, rabim hamish aderech chiyuv huayim lishtaker b'motzei Shabbos." So, levatel kriyat shema shel shacharis bizmano. He's saying that we have all these people. Motzei Shabbos, they get together, they party, they get drunk. They might call it a mava malga, and then they can't even get up for shacharis the next morning. People like to think these rabbis, they get up and they try to tell us that it's only in our generation. You know how terrible it is. They make yeshiva bachrim. When I speak to these yeshiva bachrim, they're always calling me yeshiva bachrim or coming to see me, whatever. And the thing that most amazes them, and they ask questions about, is they actually believe, many of them, that like 100 years ago, 200 years ago, everyone was pi. It's like they think people are living in B'nai Brak, you know, 100, 200 years ago. And everyone knew Shas and Poskim and all this. It's unbelievable. You know, Rabbi Gifter writes that heresy is worse in Poland, this is before the war, than it is in America. So the people are getting drunk on Saturday night. And then it says that he says that the students are being mevatel all the time. They're going on the streets. That's what he's referring to. He's saying bein hazmanim. That's what I just mentioned. And then he says that... He continues, Bizui Tamidei Chachamim, people don't treat the rabbis properly. Masel Matan Ein Be'emunah, people are not honest in their monetary dealings, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, you see, this is, it's not something new. And in many ways, we are actually at a higher level. Don't let them tell you otherwise. When it comes to learning, every single one of us, all of our children go to at least, I hope, at least 12 years of yeshiva high school. So they get to a higher level of learning. And many of them go to Israel for a year or two, if not, and then go to YU. So we actually are on a higher level, much higher level. Our Balabatim are on a higher level of learning than the Balabatim throughout Jewish history. I'm not talking about the days of the Gemara or days of Chizki HaMelech or anything like that. I'm talking about recorded Jewish history. Our Balabatim are on a higher level. I raised the question about Malkus. I mentioned, you know, who does this anymore? And in the yeshiva world, they don't do it. You might have an exception or two. But I was told that in the Hasidic world, and people can add more if they want, that they still do this symbolic Malkus. What I want to know, however, is it done Erev Yom Kippur over the shirt or under the shirt? Because I'm going to show you now Gerba, how they do it. So here's, let me share my screen with you. This was this year. So let me hold on. Let me go down here. I got it. Right. Okay. So my problem is that I couldn't see where to Let me pull it up on the screen where to click on to get it going. I'll get it right now. You'll see the Malkos. And then I'll share the screen with you. Okay. So there you have it, 39 Malkos among the Jews of Gerba. Okay. Thank you, Myron, for sending me. We spoke about Daf Yomi and how Rav Avadia is opposed to it because he says people should do halacha. I didn't know this. The Aruch HaShulchan in Yoredeya 246, Simon Reish Mem Vav, Sif Katan Yud Zayin, says the same thing. He says that those Balabatim who know how to learn, and he's speaking, it's very rare to know how to learn. He says in those days, he says that rather than learning Gemara or Poski, rather than learning Gemara, he says that they should learn Poski. And he says everyone should learn Orach Chaim and some Yoredeya, Choshen Mishpat, etc. He says, so they shouldn't learn Gemara. They should learn Halacha. But then he says, and this is the problem, he says, however, we've seen Ra'inu ki Gemara him. If you actually say to them, learn halacha, not Gemara, lo yilmadu kol ki rotzanam rak lomod daf Gemara b'chol yom. They only want to learn Gemara. Yeah, these are people who know how to learn. They've been to yeshiva. Maybe they're advanced later, whatever it is, they know how to learn. So they work all day and they have a little time every day to learn. What the Aruch HaShulchan says is really they should be learning halacha. But they don't want to learn halacha. They want to learn Gemara. And therefore, he says, don't prevent them. Halavai that they do this because all of Torah brings to Yiras Hashem. But really, unlike today where Gemara is like the high point and they sell it that everyone should learn it, the Aruch HaShulchan is saying that really that's not what people should be doing. So, but one more thing about the Malkos. I don't understand why it stopped when it stopped in the Lithuanian world. The Aruch HaShulchan mentions it explicitly. The Shulchan Aruch mentions it, by the way. The Shulchan Aruch says, Ko hakal lokim Malkos arba'im. Everyone gets arba'im Malkos. They do 39. If the Ramah says 39, and the Ramah says also, we say vidui when we do it. But the Aruch HaShulchan also says, Noagin lukos shloshim. So we see that 100 years ago it was done among the non-Hasidic world. So what happened to it? I don't know. And okay, let me do the last thing because it's already the rest I'll hold off till later dealing with weddings under the last part of the month and some other things I'll get to. Always interesting, but I do want to share something else, which is sad. None of you have heard this, I think, fortunately, because it's a local story. It could have been an international story, Chilul Hashem of massive proportions. And let me explain what I'm talking about here. Actually, let me see, first of all, if, I'll pull it up in a second for you. You recall those who were with us a few years ago where we spoke about the issue of donating money to help build the church. And the rabbis in Germany, the two of them who thought it was okay, and then because it was good neighborliness, etc. We went through all this. I don't need to repeat it. And the questions that I asked, because if you're, let's say, in the city where the church burns down and the reform and the conservative are donating, it's a problem not to. So we dealt with that. Then I mentioned how Rav Nachum Rabinovich, the great Rav Nachum Rabinovich of Mali Adumim, when you had these crazy, I don't know what you call them, even Jews in Israel who attack churches. You know, it's a big, big problem. People don't believe it if you're in Chutz Aretz. I tell people this, they don't believe it. Anyone in Israel knows what I'm talking about. I mean, they spit at priests, they do all these things. I mean, forget the Chil Hashem aspect, forget just the evil of this, how you treat someone who B'Tselem Elokim this way. This is literal pikuach nefesh. This could turn the Christian world, which today a good portion of the Christian world are our friends and helping us. Some of the Christians forget it. We've lost them. And obviously the Muslims, but we don't have them. But as long as we have a strong segment of the Christian world, this is literal pikuach nefesh and whatever the stupidity. So Rav Nachman Rabinovich held that if Jews destroy the church, we need to donate money to help it. Now, I want to show you something here. This could have become halacha lemaisa very easily. Here is something. Arson at Verona Church. Verona is the town next to where I live. New Jersey man accused of setting fire. It turns out that he didn't. He only burnt a few of the pews. The whole church didn't burn down. But this is the email that I got. Everyone member of my shul got Friday, April 5th, from the rabbi of our shul and the president. We are sorry to report that a local man and member of Congregation Or Torah, that's my shul, has been arrested and accused of arson of a local church. We have spoken to the church leadership to extend our apologies. This individual is disturbed and is being held by local authorities. We do not expect that he will be free anytime soon, but if he is, he will not be welcomed back into Congregation Or Torah. Okay, so this is a story in the local New Jersey area. By the way, the priest at the church was very nice, and the rabbi spoke about it on Shabbos. He doesn't blame the Jews, and it was just two pews that were destroyed. The guy came in late at night, but can you imagine? This is a huge church. If the whole thing had burnt down, this would have been an international story, and I think it would have been obligatory then on the Jewish community. After all, it's one of ours. Who burnt it down? I think it would have been obligatory on the Jews to donate to rebuild it. I don't think we could have got it out of that. And I think all the issues we spoke about would have come halacha lemaisa, and I'm certain that the rabbis would have decided, like the Mate Levi and like Rabbi Yehuda Tzolk'in, that under the circumstances, not just you can, but you're obligated. Obviously, some would have said no, but I think if you understand the reality of what this means, Jews burning down a Catholic church, that I don't think there's any question of where you have to. So this was a huge, huge shock. Let's just put it this way. And enough said about that. Let's now return to the Musar movement, taking it back to 1897. I showed you some great pictures last time. I'll show you some more pictures this time, including one I posted. I showed you of the Yerushalmi, Yosef Osmanovitz. I said his name was, I thought his, the Sephardic name that the tradition that they had was Dan Yechi. It actually is De Leon. So when his family moved to Israel, they changed their name to De Leon. But he changed it back to Osmanovitz. But like I said, he's known as the Yerushalmi. If you recall, I said that this terrible dispute, today we're going to speak about how the Slobodka Yeshiva, the great yeshiva, splits. And the Muslim people are the minority. They're actually, it's his yeshiva, not Sri Finkel, but it's sort of like the company hostile takeover. It's a hostile takeover of the yeshiva from the non-Muslim people. And it's actually, as we'll see, the Alter's fault that it happened. Because he loved Torah scholars so much that he brought in all these people from Volozhin closes. So where are they going to go? So the Alter brings them all into Slobodka. As long as someone was alarmed that he wanted it. The problem was these people he bring in, they wanted to learn Gemara. They didn't want Musar. So the Alter of Slobodka, because of his love of great Torah scholars, he destroyed his own yeshiva by bringing the enemy inside the gate, as it were. So we're going to see that in just a couple minutes. But if you recall, I said, and I believe this, I'm not just saying it to be theologically correct or whatever, that it was a machlokas l'shem shamayim. Those who've been with me long enough know that I don't say this loosely. There's lots of disputes in our world that are not L'shem Shemayim, and I'm not going to tell you it's L'shem Shemayim. Lots of disputes are about Kavod. But I think this was a dispute with L'shem Shemayim. Having said that, though, I need to mention, because just because it's a dispute with L'shem Shemayim for the sake of heaven, that doesn't mean that all is good. I have to tell you what Rav Yisrael Salanter, prophetically perhaps, although he confronted this in his own lifetime. The first opposition to Musser is Rabbi Stroll's own lifetime, but it's localized. Wherever where he was speaking, so the rabbi opposes him in Kovno. It's not like yeshiva, and it's not like the rabbis from all over. Because Rabbi Stroll Salanter has a famous saying. So I'll tell you the saying now, but before I do that, I'll tell you where I got the saying from. There's a list of famous sayings of Rabbi Stroll Salanter found in Dov Katz's book, Rabbi Dov Katz's book, Tnuas HaMusar, Volume 1. He has 41 sayings of Rabbi Stroll Salanter, and actually, no, not 41, sorry, many more than 41, because each section, he has about 100 or more sayings. And I can't go through, again, that would be five classes just to go through all of them with you. But and some of them you know. So, for instance, it's Rabbi Stroll Salanter who said, not everything you write, not everything you think you write down, not everything you write down you say publicly. This is, he quotes with regard to Machlokas L'shem Shamayim on page 309 the following. Actually, before I even get to that, let me just tell you quickly some, on just on this page, some of his other sayings. Rabbi Stroll Salanter, he had a great way of putting, real wisdom into one sentence. So here's just some of his sayings. These are collected from reliable sources. Writing is one of the easiest things to do. Erasing is one of the hardest. We can all appreciate that, I think. He says it's appropriate for the rabbi to give a drasha, even if the only benefit will be that one person will daven ma'ariv with kavana, and even if that one person is the rabbi himself. Rabbi Shaul says, one who goes bareheaded, and he knew about that. He was in Germany where the Orthodox Jews went bareheaded. One who goes bareheaded, it doesn't mean he's a heretic. He hasn't thrown off the yoke. But one who throws off the yoke goes bareheaded. In fact, Rav Avadya Yosef said the same thing, with the Syrians, those types who don't wear yarmulkes. He said, you're not a heretic if you don't wear a yarmulke, but in our day, the heretics don't wear yarmulkes. But this is what I'm... Oh, one more, actually, the next page, because this is a great one. You probably heard this, it knows Rabbi Stroll Salanter. The Hasidim think they have a Rebbe. The Misnagdim think they don't need a Rebbe. And both are mistaken. And just today, Moshe from Spring Valley, I think, emailed me without even knowing I was going to speak about this, He has a Hasidic book in Yiddish, which cites some things from Rabbi Stroll Salanter, and it cites this, but it whites it out in the reprint. I think it was a Hasidic text, but it whites it out because Hasidim don't like that. The Hasidim think they have a Rebbe, but the Misnagdim think they don't need a Rebbe. So, so what about Machlokas L'shem Shamayim? This is what Rabbi Stroll Salanter said. What does the Mishnah say? Every Machlokas L'shem Shamayim Sofa Liskayen will continue. There's all sorts of interpretations of that. And what does Rabbi Salanter say? Im chavanim, the machokas l'shem shamayim. If you have, as part of your machokas, you do it l'shem shamayim, in l'cha sakana gedola mizo, v'sofa liskayen. If you think in your battle against someone, it's l'shem shamayim, then there's no greater danger than that. And this is going to continue and continue. In other words, on the one hand, it's great that if we have machokas, they're doing it for l'shem shamayim. But there's also a flip side, a bad side to that. Because if they really think that they're doing l'shem shamayim, then it's not going to end. These idiot Neturei Karta people, I'm going to write about them because I have what to say. In fact, I have unpublished material to say about them. But they even came to Teaneck last week. And 2 weeks ago, they're protesting in front of the shul in Teaneck, the ultimate anti-Semitism. They're protesting in front of the shul. They think they're doing it l'shem shamayim. And therefore, you can't buy them off or anything like that. And so people who are true believers, there's no greater danger than that, because they're going to create chaos and havoc because they think they're doing it l'shem shamayim. So there's a flip side. He also says... two other things relevant to that. people feel like on Nagios, they're if they feel they're like the Tsitkos, that's that in a negative sense that he's saying. And another one, Haratz L'dvar Mitzvah Yachol Hachriv B'Darko Shel, it's called Olam. Someone who runs to do a mitzvah can destroy the entire world. Because you're running to do a mitzvah, you don't care about anyone else. I'm going to do this mitzvah. I'm going to do what I feel needs to be done. You trample everyone else. You create your own little minion where everything is done perfectly, and everyone else is left. You don't care about them because they're not up to your level. This is really Rishos Lander. But I repeat though. Well, yes, the Machlokas is Lashem Shamayim, but as we know, Rabbi Feimer was Lashem Shamayim. But the things he said was just outrageous. Where can you be led to with that? We spoke about Rabbi Meir Feimer's letter in 57, 1897, March, and then shortly after that, I said the dispute breaks out in the Musar Yeshiva. This is the first dispute in the Musar Yeshiva we're going to speak about. Then there's a second dispute in the Musar Yeshiva, and even I think we can talk about a third dispute. We'll definitely speak about the first two disputes. This is event that is the Musar, the first of the great Musar disputes in the yeshivas. We're going to speak about what happens in Tells and other places as well. But the first one is at the Musar Yeshiva, which is the par excellence, the first Musar Yeshiva, Sobotka, and it's significant because the revolt breaks out among the students. And the opposition, much of the opposition is directed against the head of the yeshiva, Rav Natzali Tzvi Finkel, the Alter. We think today, how could anyone be opposed to the Alter, such as the tzaddik, the Alter, but they were. And here's the Alter. And we have many pictures of the Alter of Sobotka, so here's of one of them. This is all older here, so I assume he's already in Eretz Yisrael, but maybe not. There is no question, though, that although this is from the yeshiva students, that outside forces from both the rabbis, and we'll see which rabbis in particular, and maskilim were influencing the students. And the students themselves included both big talmidei chachamim, iluyim, and also people in Kohen Haskalah. Every yeshiva had people like that. So who was the Alter, Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel? In Hebrew, they call him the Saba, but the Alter. He was a student of one of Rishos Salanter's three students. Rishos Salanter had three great students, two of whom were in Kovno Sobotka at this time. Those two were Yitzhak Blazer, and the other was Rav Naftali Amsterdam. We spoke about both of them. The other was Rav Simcha Zissel of Kelm. I think we'll probably speak a little bit about him as well because he was quite unique. He opened a yeshiva with secular studies. So we'll speak about him. The Slobodka Yeshiva. Slobodka is right outside Kovno. When I was there 2 summers ago, the person taking me around said the building doesn't exist anymore. I don't know what became of it. I don't know if that's true, but this person apparently knows a lot about Jewish history. It doesn't exist anymore. So Slobodka is a suburb, I guess you would say, of Kovno over the river. The yeshiva is established in the early 1880s. You might see dates, 1882, 3. We don't exactly know the date, and it's hard to know when a yeshiva is actually established. It starts in one of the local shuls, and when's the exact date? We don't know. And it's the first yeshiva to devote significant time to the organized study of Musar at a time when most of the rabbinic world was opposed to this. What you had before that is you had the little like how Musar house that Yishol Salanter created, and he would come speak to them. So here, for the first time, you get a yeshiva, whereas part of the yeshiva learning, you have the mashgiach speaking to them, not like the Yishol Salanter speaking in a shul to balabatim, but speaking to people who are supposed to be studying Gemara all day. That's their job. And when I say Gemara, I mean Gemara. If you read Rav Gifter's letter, it's amazing how negative he is on studying for Rabbonus, getting smicha. And he's saying, I can't do that. It's a terrible thing. It's a takeaway from my learning. He doesn't like it when he hears that one of his friends in America is studying for smicha. That's what you do at the end when you have to get a position or Rabbonus. You study for smicha. For some reason, like in the last 10 years in America, they're making such a big deal about smicha. Everyone gets smicha. They have all these programs, like the Pirchei Sheshanim has programs, so everyone can study for smicha. I guess it's sort of like you got to deal with what you're presented with. People, that's going to encourage them to be involved in learning. But you read Rav Gifter, the ideas are to spend time on Yoredeya, learning pots and pans. That's not what real learning is. If you want to be a technician, when you have to paskin, you have to learn it. But real learning is yeshiva learning. So you're going to have mussar schmoozes, that's what they call them, the schmooze, during in yeshivas. And you're also going to have a seder. Figure half hour. Some places it could be longer, but Sabukka, we're told it's a half hour between Melech HaMarav every day, where that's what you will learn. So you're saying that just learning Gemara is not enough to keep you pious and connected to God. And what was the altar's job? He didn't give shiurim. He wasn't going to give shiurim in Gemara. Next class or the class after, we'll talk about briefly how much of a lamdan was the altar. I mean, was he a goan in learning or not? This is always an interesting question because you have it in Israel also, America Zarav, from Tzvi Yehuda Cook. He functions like the Altar Sabatka did, basically, in different contexts. He's teaching not Musar, but Emuna, or of Tau. I mean, are these people goanim and learning, or are just, and if they're not, that's also a problem in the yeshiva world because, usually, only someone who's an expert in shas and poskins, backwards and forwards, is the one supposed to speak to us and craft our responses to, a Torah response. The idea that we're going to let people who don't know the Ketzos backwards and forwards and don't, are not Lamdanim Muvhakim, that's also going to be something new. And much of the disputes in the Musar Yeshivas focus on the Mashgiach. It's very rarely to focus on the Rosh Yeshiva. And the only times we see disputes in the yeshivas when they focus on the Rosh Yeshiva is Dafka when they think the Rosh Yeshiva is not up to par, like Rav Chaim Berlin. Rav Chaim Berlin, the students revolted. Rav Chaim Berlin, now he's famous. He has a yeshiva named after him, and he's one of the Gedolim. But when he was appointed Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin, the students didn't think very highly of him, and they revolted against it. They didn't want nepotism. They wanted the best. The altar's job was the menahel. He ran the yeshiva. He was also, they have a new title, mashgiach. Not the mashgiach of the food, the mashgiach of the souls. His job is to know all the students, to speak to them, to be a spiritual guide. Anyone who's been to yeshiva knows there's a mashgiach. His job, or sometimes his job, is to make sure you're in the Beis Medrash and you're not missing learning time. His job is to speak to the students, to inspire them, to give a schmooze, to know every individual. It's an important role, but it's different, of course, than a Rosh Yeshiva. Anyone who's been to YU, you knew Rabbi Blau or the people before that, Rabbi Lessin. Obviously, an American-born Rosh Yeshiva, American-born Mashgiach is going to be different than a European-born, but he was the Menahel and or the Mashgiach. And it's his yeshiva. As the Mashgiach, he would advocate a new doctrine of Musar. Earlier ideas of Musar, and even in the, say, pre-Musar, Musarites, if you want to call them that, they would stress the natural defects of the human personality, that we're weak, we have temptations. We're made from dust, and who are we? We're far from God and far from where we should be. And by stressing this, how defective we are as people, this would encourage Jews to, I guess, be devoted to God and uproot all their negative traits, because we have a lot of negative traits. And common Musar theme was all the negative traits we have. Well, the Altar of Sobotka had a completely different approach, whether because he thought fundamentally there should be a different approach, or just because in the era he was in, you couldn't use the old approach, which often verged into fire and brimstone type of talk. And the Altar of Sobotka, rather than stressing the defective nature of humanity and what we lack, he stressed the positive side, the dignity, the majesty of humanity, how we're one step below an angel. If God made us, then we're so, what an unbelievable creature. Look how he made us. And therefore, We need to be honest and true to ourselves. We were made in such a, in God's image at such a level. That's going to inspire us to understand what it means to be a servant of God and a creation of God. That's going to bring us close to God. We recognize who we are. Only one who views himself this way will be able to be closely bound to God and devote himself. I want to read you something from, I thought he does a good job summarizing it just in one page, Kamenetsky in Making of a Gadol. I said I have PDFs of Making of a Gadol, and loads of people are emailing me from all over. People are not live with us. So I sent out probably 10 different copies of this, if not more, in the last week. Let me read you on page 579 just one example from one individual who recorded one of the shmuzes of the altar. And it's just in summary form, repeating what I said. The altar first proved how exalted the created world is by the fact that the Almighty himself took the, quote, trouble to create it. How often did our other Musar teachers speak about how this world is meaningless? It's nothing. The only point of this world is to get you into the world to come and being mevatel everything in this world. Someone, Kamenetsky records how one of the yeshiva students who yet, hadn't yet understood what Slobodka Musar is was being mevatel Einstein and said, Einstein, what good is Einstein? What does Einstein know? He's, Torah is the only thing important, whatever he was saying. And the altar said, he said, you're an idiot. It's just like that. You don't recognize, I mean, if you can't go out and see the eclipse and see, the world we're in. So let me read on. God himself created this world, not through a fiery angel, not through a messenger. All the things we're going to say next week, the week after. God himself created this world. Breaking down its components, the altar showed how the speaking creature, that is us, the man, the medaber, is the crown of creation. Of all speaking creatures. And what's the crown of the speaking creatures? Israel. And within Klal Yisrael, those who are dedicated to the study of Torah are the select. And who are the most select of the select? The Slabodka Yeshiva students. Why is that? Because the Slabodka Yeshiva student studies Torah and Musar and understands this message. He has reached the highest level. So therefore, every member of the audience must weigh his every deed to assure that the dignity of his august position in the zenith of creation be maintained. It's a very different message. It's telling you what you're lacking, how much you're missing. And the only way you're going to make something of yourself is to come close to God. No, you already have everything. And the only way you're going to keep everything you have and lose it is by staying connected to God. Look, some people want to go to these military schools where all they do is tell you you're nothing, but and what you're missing. Incidentally, if you read Nassim Kamenetsky's writings, you maybe just got a sense from these few lines. His use of the English language was something else. Never had a college education. I don't even know if he graduated high school. But yet he had such an English language. Sometimes I have to look up in the dictionary the words he uses. Had he gone to college, maybe he would have had a writing professor to teach him how to write, because this is the most disorganized, out crazy book. Everything put, so they could have taught him the form, but the matter, the content, he already has, and the his use of the English language, it's really something else. Let me tell you. Hey, look, he comes from a genius family, and his father, Rav Yaakov, I'm just finishing Emes LeYaakov on his father on Nach. They put out the second volume. They call it actually volume one because the Chelek Beis was put out before it. But there was no one like Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. And I don't know if people realize this. Yes, he's a Rosh Yeshiva, just like we say, there's no one like the Rav, which is true. Rav Soloveitchik was Rosh Yeshiva, doing whatever what Rosh Yeshiva does, but he was special in all the ways he spoke about. Rav Yaakov also. None of the other Rosh Yeshiva knew Diktuk like him, knew Tanakh like him, knew, I mean, he knew things that I think I can say without fear of contradiction that none of the other Rosh Yeshiva in his day knew. Quite a unique individual. So that's the house that he was raised in. On the next page, he gives examples, that what I spoke about last class, and I'll show you more. You're a Sobotka student, you need to stress dress, because if you're exalted from the divine, you can't walk around with your shirt hanging out and with a stain on your shirt and with a hole in your jeans. I mean, you need to look like a million bucks, and they had no money, so they look as best as they could. And so Kamenetsky says the altar felt that this appearance of Torah would raise Kavanah Torah in the eyes of laymen and raise the pupil's self-esteem. And he tells a story how one student, Mordechai Karlinsky, unbuttoned his shirt and took out his tzitzis for kissing during the reading of the Shema, and he was reprimanded by the altar after davening and said, "We don't do that here. It's not nice to undo your shirt in public." And then he quotes his father that Rav Yaakov did not allow the students in his yeshiva to walk around. Like, when they put their tefillin on, sometimes they put the jacket over their arm. They have the tefillin on, but the arm is not in the sleeve. And Rav Yaakov thought that that's not a dignified look. It's better not to wear any jacket, I guess, than walk around like that. Incidentally, let me tell you something. In Sobotka, no yeshiva in Europe did they wear the tzitzis out. Not one. Not even in Radin. And it's in Radin that the Chafetz Chaim, he writes that you should have the tzitzis out, although it's not clear, actually, he's referring to our tzitzis. I mentioned before, Rabadi thinks he's talking about people. He says you shouldn't be in your pockets, so they speak about people that have the tzitzis over the shirt. So if you have those tzitzis over the shirt, then you don't tuck it in. He's not speaking about people, apparently, that have our tzitzis. But I can just tell you, no one had the tzitzis out. And this leads to a terrible thing I heard when I was in yeshiva from one of my rebbes from the Mill. And but I'll repeat it because it's part of the history. He said, told us as follows, that that the Rayatz, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, was ill. He was in. He couldn't stand. By the end of his life, he was, I guess, in a wheelchair. He didn't. I don't know what illness it was. Nachum Shmariyahu will email me what his illness was. So this is what I heard from my Rebbe in ninth grade or 10th grade. Can you believe this is what they told the students? That you know why the Lubavitcher Rebbe was punished with this? Here's the story. He once was together with some yeshiva bachurim, Sobotka Mir, I don't know, whichever it was. And in Shema, they didn't take out their tzitzis to kiss. So the Rayatz asked one of the yeshiva students, "How come they don't kiss? How come you don't take your tzitzis out to kiss?" And the yeshiva student, as a joke, said, "Well, because we don't wear tzitzis." And the Rayatz, this is the story. I'm not saying this ever happened, but in the Mir, this was a story. This is my Rebbe. He was in Shanghai, actually, and he said the Rayatz took it seriously, and then he starts telling everyone that the yeshiva students don't wear tzitzis. And because of that, that's why he was punished. So I apologize to any Lubavitchers, but this is the story that I was told in yeshiva. But it shows you though that they didn't take out your tzitzis, to kiss the tzitzis in Shema. No, you don't take your tzitzis out. It's in your shirt. You're saying Shema, and your shirt is hanging to the side. That's not what a Sobotka student does. Then he continues. He tells that about another Sobotka story with the altar. He came to the Beis Medrash with a button missing from his jacket. So the altar told him, "Do me a favor. Don't come to the yeshiva until you fix the jacket." And there's more stories he goes through, famous stories. The altar would give money and go with them to the tailor to make sure they had good clothes. Okay, I don't need to give any more of these stories, but famous stories from the altar and why it's so important how you dress. The altar would give his shmuzen, which had been published, many of them. They were published by the students. He didn't write them down, but they recorded them, and they were very meaningful to some of the students. You can imagine, right when You're all, and I've seen it myself, and it still exists. You're learning. You're in the middle of a sugya. It's Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. Everything's going great, and someone gives a clap on the table that Musar. You know, the mashgiach is going to speak for a half hour or an hour, could be an hour, and yeah, the Hasidim of the mashgiach, they'll listen and they'll get sick. And what do the other guys think? They can't leave. We spoke about that last class. You can't leave. But they want to learn. Well, some of them will leave, but that, you're not supposed. They want to learn Gemara, and here their thoughts. They're in the middle of a Tosfos. They're in the middle. They're all getting ready, and all of a sudden, Musar. It breaks them. I see David Eisen. Do they have Musar at Har Etzion? They didn't have it. Okay, so that's Volozhin. It continues Volozhin, I guess. But you know, you have it. Why you? They have the Mashgiach there. So that was what he would do. Now, I don't think for us, for most of us listening, you'll have a hard time understanding what I'm going to tell you now. But we have some people who've never been to yeshiva. We have women, lots of women who listen to the classes, which is great, but they have never been to yeshiva, most of them, or many of them. In fact, when I was young, the girls went to yeshiva. That's what they called it in Israel. Now they call it seminary. So, but some of them, from the older generation haven't been to seminary either. So, maybe you won't appreciate this personally, but so I have to share it. If your only exposure to teachers and students is at a high school, typical high school, university, you can't begin to appreciate the connection of a student of Torah to his Rebbe. And you can multiply this many times over when you have a figure like the Elder of Slabodka. For those who were in his corner, the connection was very, very strong in both ways. They looked to him as a father figure, and they loved him. And he was a father figure to them. In fact, look, it would be fascinating to hear a psychologist's opinion of the Elder, because he did not give his own children any preference in education over the yeshiva students. Can you imagine what it was like growing up in that house when your father does not favor you over the students? I mean, aniyei yircha, you're supposed to favor your own. First, your own family, your own city, but for the altar, they all were his children. And the altar had a number of children. Only one of the children went off the derech, to use that expression. Only one became irreligious, came to America. The rest became religious. So that's quite unusual in that period. Although, let me say, I shouldn't say it's quite unusual in that period, because the altar, his children were, actually, no, he was the period. I mean, the worst period is maybe 10 years. But he had, I'm talking about now, his children were in the 1880s, or some of them from the 1890s. So it's unusual that most of them remained religious. I'll show you some pictures as well of his son, one of his great sons. But the Alter was an integral part of the yeshiva student's life, much more than a Rebbe. How do you get close to a Rebbe? You get close to a Rebbe because you want to be close to him. You talk to him, you remain after Shir, you follow him, you walk with him. Who was it that said the difference between Shaul Lieberman and the Rav? When Shaul Lieberman finished his class, he left, he went back to his office, and that was that. When the Rav finished his shiur, you had a whole group of students walking with him to wherever he was going, to his apartment. But that's one way, really, the students to the Rebbe. And then the Rebbe opens himself if he wishes. However, the altar, it was two ways, because the altar would seek out the students. And for those students who were amenable, he would invite them to his apartment to schmooze, to talk. He wanted to know you intimately. And he was then able to influence you. He influenced the students, not just in the public talks, but one-on-one discussions. He had all sorts of educational ideas and theories and practices that he influenced, like we saw with the Sri Yeshiva, Yitzchak of Weinberg. He said some gutter of Naftali's Amsterdam and apologize for lying to him. And those who followed him, who believed in him, and this is going to be about a quarter of the yeshiva, that's it. They hung on his every word. They would repeat his schmoozing till they knew exactly what he's saying. They would imitate he would look at his fingers when he spoke, they say, because he had stage fright. So when they gave their like mini schmooze, and they would look at their fingers. They were really indoctrinated into Musar through him and had a very strong connection. So much so that Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg writes that not just his parents, the parents and the altar forced him to get married. The Altdorfs, you know what I think? It's not so much the parents. He was already 20 years old or something. How can the parents force him to marry this girl from the Pilvishok? You know the story if you've read my book. This girl who was a simple girl and they had nothing in common. But you marry her, you get the Rabbonus in Pilvishki. But he says the altar also, he says, my parents in the altar. What I think it is, it's the altar. I don't think he cared what his parents said so much. But if the altar says to him, Yechiel Yankiv, you're going to marry this girl because then you'll get the Rabbonus and it'll be good for you. If the altar says to marry her, you marry her. And to his credit, Rabbi Weinberg, even though it destroyed his life, he never held a grudge against the altar and never badmouthed the altar after this. He had his criticisms, but he never badmouthed the altar. And he never said, you destroyed 20 years of my life, forcing me into a marriage. But if the altar says it, you listen. That's the Das Torah. Even we're not even talking Torah here. We're talking your life. Like we said, the altar felt that, you have to be dignified, how you dress, how you groom yourself, and this is going to affect how you feel on the inside. It'll give you the respect to the masses. It'll allow you to reach your spiritual potential. David Fishman from the seminary, he's listened to a number of our classes in the past. In fact, he was an active participant in one series, I think on the Netziv. He wrote a classic article on the Vardik Musar. In order to understand Nevardic Musar, we'll get into Nevardic Musar because much of the attacks are against Nevardic. You have to contrast it to its opposite, Sabbatka Musar. And he summarizes as follows, quote, Sabbatkait Musar internalized the modern bourgeois values of orderliness, personal hygiene, dignity and restraint, and magnified their importance above and beyond any position they may have held in the traditional Jewish scale of values. Yes, the altar magnified it way above what they were traditionally. However, now in the 19th century, when you can go to university and people are treating you with dignity and putting you on a pedestal because you're a university student and you're wearing your uniform and all that, the yeshiva student have to be the same thing. As I said last time, the chitzoniot has to reflect the panimios. If you dress improperly, it shows there's something wrong on the inside. So it's both. It's about in society, if this is how what's reviewed as today as a proper way of dressing, you have to dress that way, one. And two, it reflects a spiritual thing that how you dress on the outside is a reflection of how you view yourself on the inside. Do you show yourself? Do you think that you're the creation of God at the highest possible level? And every day you are. So it's not just when you appear before the Tzar you have to dress this way. You always have to dress this way because you're a creature of God, and that's a spiritual value. I showed you some pictures. Let me show you a couple other pictures. I showed you this picture last class of the Sosmanovitz, with his bride, the daughter of Ramosha Mordechai Epstein. That's the Yerushalmi. But let me show you some more pictures. Here's another Slobodka picture. This person in the middle, that's Rav Huttner. And look how they're dressed. Look at their hair. Are they even wearing yarmulkes? Looks like the one on the left looks like he has it, but I don't know. Maybe not. They took off the yarmulkes maybe for the picture. That's Slobodka. You look like $1 million. You feel like $1 million. Now you're suited to learn Torah and study Musar. Because you treat yourself the way God wants you to be treated. Let me show you some more. Hold on. I have all this stuff for you on the screen here, on my screen. Ah, here you. Here's a picture that I posted. Oh, no, sorry. This is, I'll get to this in a second. No. This is Rav Moshe Finkel, the son of the altar. He dies at 1925 is when he comes to Eretz Yisrael to be in the Chevron Yeshiva. He's regarded as an Iwa. He was a Rebbe in the Chevron Yeshiva. That's his wife, the Moshe Mordechai Epstein's other daughter. So their brother-in-law's with him in the Yerushalmi. But look at him. Look at the dignity. Look how he's dressed. Incidentally, also, look how she looks. And look how she's holding his arm. Would a Rebbe in Yeshiva today ever take a picture with his wife holding his arm like that? This is what he looks like later. As time goes on, they need to, when you become the Rebbe in Yeshiva or Ram, this is how you have to look. This is, I mean, he always, this is also, he was a Ram, but a younger Ram. Because as far as I know, he always was involved in Yeshiva in some way, unless maybe in the early years after he got married, he wasn't giving a shiur. So this, I can't say whether this picture is before he's giving a shiur or not, but that's from Moshe Finkel. They say he was a genius, but he died young. Here's another picture. You should be able to recognize it now. In those days, you can make postcards where you put your picture in, you send it. So here's a postcard from Israel, Eretz Yisrael, 1928. That's Rav Huttner, right in the middle. Next to him is Rav, his, another Chevron student. His name was Dov Mayani. In other yeshivas, they might think these things have no value, how you dress. Hold on, I think I have another picture to show you. No, maybe not. Now, let me just add one more point and see the questions. You might be looking at this, the way they're dressed with the suit and so formal, and say, yes, that's sheevish dress like you have today, but it's not. It's very, very different. These people are dressing the way any, well-dressed person dresses, and that's what's thought to be appropriate. Today, the yeshiva world is different. They wear white and black, and they wear a black hat. Who wears a black hat today? The only people who wear black hats are people in the yeshiva world. And yeah, people do wear suits. So if it was just a suit, if they just wore the suit and a white shirt, okay, maybe you can make the claim, but you can't. Once they wear the black hat, you can't. Because what is the purpose of the yeshiva world? It's dress. What's the yeshiva dress? It's sectarian. It's designed to be sectarian, to separate, separators. Sectarian in the sense of separation. It's designed to separate the yeshiva student from the world around it. Not just the world that wears jeans or regular clothes, but even people who dress, like in your law firm, you dress that way every day, but you don't wear a hat. The purpose of the dress today is to create a cadre of yeshiva students who are separate, different from the world out there. That was not the purpose of the dress in the yeshiva world, on the contrary, in the Musar world. On the contrary, the way you dafka were supposed to dress, the way the elites dressed in those days. Because that's what people thought was kavod, to dress like this. Today, no one in the yeshiva world any thinks about kavod. You're not dressing that way because of kavod. People are going to look at you in the outside world and see that way. Or you're going to feel like $1 million being, a God's creation because you dress like this. It has nothing to do with that. There's a whole different philosophy behind it. So it's not a continuation at all. And those who know the history of the dress know that the whole dressing in black, when did that even start? In the 1980s, I guess. Before that, the yeshiva world, they never dressed in black. It says in the Gemara that you dress in black if you want to go somewhere and commit a sin. The only people dressed in black were the Rosh Yeshiva. You're not supposed to dress in black. Dafka, because people didn't dress in black. I assume this is an influence of the Hasidic world. Okay, we need to continue still more with more activities and ideas of the Alter Sabotka, and then we'll see the great explosion, how it explodes, why it explodes, and who's behind the explosion, and what this leads to. Complete break in the yeshiva. And as a result of this, we come to the document Leman Das, where the Gedolim set their sights on the Musar Yeshivas. And wait till you see what the response of the Musar figures are to the Gedolim. Shows you that it isn't just a modern thing where you say, well, that could be their Das Torah, but I don't have to follow their Das Torah because we have our own Das Torah. Okay, let me go back to take some of the questions and comments. Moshe has a hard time not saying a bracha without Shema Malchus. So is that amazing? Well, there are those who say you can say it with Shema Malchus. Rav Eliezer Melamed, I think Rav Nissim Karelitz. If you look in the Pinin Halacha, he quotes the sources that say you can say it. I think Rav Nissim Karelitz. Basically, the Gemara gives times you say it. So do we say those are the only times? Or those are just examples? There, David says, Rav Melamed concurs that make the bracha. Yeah. Well, that's a picture of Yosef Feinberg the first. Yes, you're right. It's the article was about the son, the grandson of Yosef Feinberg the second, who was a rabbi in Borough Park. David, you said comments about Rav Palayef. I have much of the material which was given to me as well. Moshe said the Shlomo's father talks about Bein HaZmanim in his commentary on the Shmona Prokim of the Rambam. There's always these, you have a number of people who attack the Bein HaZmanim, but I don't exactly understand. I mean, yeshiva students, they learn hard. They're learning. They need a break also. So I don't understand what the criticism is of the Bein HaZmanim. Granted, during time of war, then not only do you need the extra learning, but there's something very distasteful, especially, and I think the Haredi world should understand this, when the young people in the rest of Israel are risking their lives and there are funerals constantly for just to go visit the sites. It's not something appropriate. But other than that, I mean, if you're not Revel Yashav or someone like that, I think he spoke against Bein HaZmanim. He can learn, 16, 17 hours a day, every day of the week, every year. But most people need a little break to rejuvenate. In fact, the rabbis also. I don't know if I told you this story, or maybe I did. Rav Gorin mentions in his autobiography that he heard this from Rav Kook. When Rav Kook was a young rabbi, he, during his time off, whenever this was, like before Elul, whatever, the rabbis also got a few weeks off. So the rabbis would go to these like resort areas, the woods. They'd walk through the woods, do what they do. And he was at one of these resorts, sitting in the woods, learning. There's, in fact, this famous picture of Baruch Be'er Leibowitz and Rabbi Gorelick, and I think Rav Shimon, no, the Marcheshes, in one of the woods, relaxing. So he was, Rav Kook started, was learning. And the Rav came over to him, this elderly Rav, and said, close the Gemara. He said that your community gives you these few weeks vacation in order to rejuvenate and recover your strength. They didn't, if you're just going to sit and learn like you usually do, then what do they need to give you the vacation for? You could be doing this in the city you're from. He was from Boisk, Rav Kook, or Zoymel, the two cities he was Rav of. He said it's Geneva. The only reason they gave you this time off was to rejuvenate. So therefore, you shouldn't learn Gemara. Doesn't mean you don't learn any Gemara, but you can't have the same Seder. You got to relax a little. You have to take walks, learn, read things that are not as intensive. So if the Rabboni need a break, the students need a break also. Thomas says, you've been to Sephardi shuls where they do Malkus. Yeah, I want to know if the Hasidim do it under the shirt or not. You can be sure the altar of Sobotka would say that just to pull your shirt out like that's there's something undignified about that. Okay, so Wikipedia says the quote is attributed to the Kotzker. Not everything needs to be said, needs to be written. But Dov Katz attributes it to Yisrael Salanter, and I always heard it from Yisrael Salanter. I didn't hear from the Kotzker. Kotzker has all sorts of great sayings himself. Wikipedia is such that anyone can put it in. If I want to finish now and then go to Wikipedia, I can delete that and put in something else. So unless there's a source in it, it doesn't really help us. I don't know. Good question, Moshe. Where did the moniker Alter come from? I mean, they see him as like a grandfatherly figure that, because he's not just an old man giving a shiur, he's involved in their life. He wants to speak to them. So I always assume that that's why they start calling him the altar, just like your Zadie, wants to know what's going on with you. But I've never seen any discussion of it. And what I'm, or I shouldn't say that. Maybe I have, but I don't remember. I'll look Dov Katz. His volume four is, volume three is completely devoted to the altar of Sobotka. So he must explain. Who he might say who the first person is, why he was called it, but I will check and report next week. And I got other stuff to report next week about sushi, all sorts of interesting things. Someone privately mentions a Rav Gifter railed against the Rav's holy man of faith. How can anyone know the psyche of Adam Arishon? Rav Gifter changes. It's interesting that he's a Kanai in his early years, and then when he's in Waterbury, he's not a Kanai. He's a rabbi in Waterbury. He taught some at Yeshiva Rabbi Tzolk'in, and he wants, what we learn from these letters is he wanted desperately to be part of Rav Soloveitchik's yeshiva in Boston. Rav Chaim Halevi. He asked for an intervention of Rav Binyamin Bach, who was a student of the Rav, to get him in there. He wanted to be either Mashkiach or to teach. And he speaks very highly of the Rav. In fact, in one place he says, he says, your Rebbe, he says, the Bach is one of the leaders now of the Agudas Yisrael. I want to hear what he says. But then later, oh, and in Waterbury, that's when you have the letters that this they won't publish. But I've written about it, and I have copies, letters to Ruy Ginsburg, who's a Telzer. Rav Gifter writes to him, your Sefer and your Yerushalmi kept me up at night. But then he becomes more of a Kanai again. But I tell you, even when he's a Kanai with Seichel and understanding. It's just, and he's not a Kanai in certain areas. In some areas, for example, he's much more to the right than Yeshivas Rabbi Tzolk'in and many other Rosh Yeshiva. In Telz, you couldn't go to college. It was standard in those days to go to college at night. In Telz, it forbids you to go. But he has a great letter to his son, Rav Zalman. Printed all the letters from his father, no censorship. It's in which after Entebbe, you had these people in Israel who were talking about this was a terrible thing, the Entebbe raid. They put Jewish lives at risk. They shave al tase. This is going to lead to kochi. We're going to think that we're. And Rav Gifter thinks this is all insane. He's saying this has nothing to do with Zionism. We can oppose what Zionism stands for, but this is God doing a miracle for us, and God does miracles for every Jew, whether you're religious, non-religious. So he can't, and he says to his son, keep away from those crazies. So now I have a really a lot of respect for Rav Gifter from reading these letters. He's such a complex person, and yes, he's a Kanai in certain areas. He's allowed to be. MJ Franco says Mashkiach at the altar was certainly a new position, but not the title, which existed previously. Yeah, the Mashkiach used to be, just to make sure, everything was running properly, like the Menahel. But this is a Musar Mashkiach. David says Hebrew Wikipedia attributes the quote to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And I have to tell you that Dov Katz says that all these quotes, Dov Katz is a careful scholar. He says these quotes are reliably attested, either in print or by students of students of Yisrael Salanter. Moshe says that the disciple called Yaakov Kamenetsky the Chacham Hador. That's interesting. Look, there are many, many, though, Gedolim and Gaonim who knew Shas and Poskim, but I don't know if any of them knew the things that Yisrael Salanter did, to know Masorah. In fact, that's to know what Yaakov did, to know Masorah. I even mentioned in my book, Changing, not Changing the Limits of Orthodox Theology, where Yaakov Kamenetsky cites, because the most important work on the Masorah is a work written by a guy named Ginsberg. He has all the, first of all, he published editions of Tanakh with the different manuscripts, but he also has a whole big volumes on Masorah. And so Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky knew exactly who he was, and he refers to him as Chaf Dalet Ginsberg. If I'm not mistaken, he doesn't say Ginsberg. I think he, I take that back. He might not say, he might just say Ginsberg. But Chaf Dalet Ginsberg is how he's known in his Sfarim on the Masorah. But you have to know a little bit that Chaf Dalet Ginsberg is Christian David Ginsberg. He's a Meshumad. But what can you do? He's the one who has the important Masoretic works. Who other than Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky knows the Masoretic works of Ginsberg? Incidentally, the great J.J. Kimchi from Harvard, the one who's fighting the good battle against the anti-Semites there, he's getting a PhD now at Harvard, his dissertation topic is on Christian David Ginsberg, who, in addition to Masorah, wrote about Kabbalah, all sorts of things. He wasn't just a Meshumad, you should know. He was a proselytizer. He was a Macy's, he was trying to get Jews to become Christian. Gershon says, did I say Yisrael Salanter said that a machlokas l'shem shamayim will survive implies that people think their machlokas l'shem shamayim will never give up. Yes, but because if they think their machlokas is l'shem shamayim, then you can't bribe them, you can't convince them otherwise, and this is a great sakana. The flip side is that this is a great thing because they're doing it for positive purposes. But the bad side is that, you know, lots of bad things can happen because they just won't give up. And this will cause, like I said, bring chaos to the Jewish people, because if your opinion is idiotic and is evil, but you think it's right and you think it's Hashem Shemayim, then you're going to cause terrible, terrible things. And Neturei Karet is a perfect example. I have no doubt that what they're doing is Hashem Shemayim. But look, they're still Rishayim Gemurim. And you have to execute people, even if you execute someone, even if he does something l'shem shamayim. If he's a zaken mamre l'shem shamayim, I mean, these people are just evil. What can we say?
Did you think that was a pshat in the Mamre Chazal?
Do you think it's pshat in the Mamre Chazal? No. He doesn't think it's pshat in the Mamre Chazal. He's giving it, in other words, he doesn't think this is what Chazal meant. He's explaining another way of reading it. That's what Yisrael does. He takes a Maimar Chazal and he adds his own twist. Rabbi Yellen says that at MTJ, the Mashgiach gave Musar Shmuz every Wednesday before Mincha. But how long is it? You know, is it 15 minutes? Is it half hour? Is it an hour? That's also an issue.
35
MJ
minutes.
Frankel says,
35 minutes.
35 minutes? Okay.
35 minutes.
Today, all the yeshivas basically have Musar. Very rare, except for Volozhin and, I guess, Gush. In YU, back in the day, Rav Lesson would only very infrequently enter a shiur room and give a short shmooze, which didn't depend on the daily routine. He also gave a voluntary attendance shmooze in the basement. Yes, there was like a Musar club where they would go to. Rabbi Rakefet became quite close to Rabbi Lesson. Rabbi Rakefet claims to be the only YU student ever to have smicha from Rabbi Lesson. I don't know if that's true. So you say you don't think it's fair to call YU the 1670s a Musar yeshiva. You're right. If you don't have a Musar shmooze that everyone has to listen to, I guess it's not. But today it is, because you're in the base medrash, and Rabbi Blau will give his Musar shmooze, and you know, it's in the main base medrash. David says, in my years at Haaretz Zion, Musar Sfarim were started individual. And then you have the quote of Reb Chaim. We're going to get to Reb Chaim, because Reb Chaim's quote, what Reb Chaim told Yitzhak Blazer, as to why they don't bring Musar into the yeshiva. Now, Musar, though, that's not Musar. Musar has to be as a group. It has to have a mashkiach. It has to be done in an organized way. Otherwise, yes. Yeah, so we will we'll get back to what Reb Chaim said. The Rav
Rabbi Lissin's son.
And we'll get back to the response to Reb Chaim. Yes?
Rabbi Lessin's son is a member of my shul, YU,
yeah,
and he's a distinguished hand surgeon.
Ah, very nice. So his daughter married Rabbi Avigdor Miller, who also came out of the Musar tradition, but he himself was a big kanoi, and said really some crazy stuff, outrageous stuff when you read his writings. And I'm shocked that they print it. Because racial stuff, and also I'm shocked that they don't realize it's not sort of the print. But to his credit, Rabbi Avigdor Miller, among other things, I mean, he has a lot of credit. Although some of his things that he said are just, you can't repeat it today. It's just not acceptable. But he did, he's like the first one to speak about the sexual abuse issue. And he stood up for that. And when everyone was putting it under the carpet, so that's, despite some of his other crazy views that I don't even want to say what they are, but you go online, you can find them. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky told me personally, you're saying that he read the works of Shakespeare in Russian. You were part of a small group who studied selection of Shulchan Aruch with him, and he was and at the time was also a literature teacher in the Torah Vadas High School. You're saying he taught literature? In what language? Which literature? Look, he read all the literature. He says that someone who didn't, what is Rav?
Do you hear me? I was a literature teacher, but some students didn't want to read Shakespeare, and I asked them what I should do with them. He said, Besser soll sie lesen Shakespeare.
That's,
I heard this personally.
In the book of his son, he gave instructions as to which works of literature. I think he mentioned Shakespeare as things to teach, and he couldn't tolerate when people in yeshivas said, how can we teach this sort of thing? In fact, he's quoted as saying, I believe it's maybe there that he was shocked where someone had never read. You never read Anna Karenina? I mean, that's what he did when he was in Russia.
There was a Hasidish boy in my literature class who was disrupting the class. I was a student of Rabbi Yaakov, so I asked him, what should I do? He says, Bessel Lezen Shakespeare. I heard this many, many years ago, but and therefore I was able to come to the student and I said, Rabbi Yaakov said you should read it, and the kid shut up.
Okay, well, we see. Listen, so that was, you can, if you read Making of a God, you get an appreciation of that. He was that sort of individual. Though, you know, I never read Anna Karenina till this summer. It's a long book. I haven't read War and Peace yet. But, you know, and I'm a little surprised that that's the book that Rav Yaakov was shocked he didn't read, someone didn't read, because if you haven't read it, I mean, one of the major themes in this is an adulterous relationship. Anna is involved in an adulterous relationship and gets pregnant from this relationship. But look, it's great literature. And Shmuel says, Yeshiva Slavitz Chaim claims that their dress code of hats and jackets is kavod ha'adam. And Rav Chenoch Leibowitz said wearing a hat is inherently part of a culture that values themselves. Look, all the yeshiva students wear hats. I showed you the picture. I showed you the picture last class of every time they all wore hats. To be a dignified person in those days, you wore a hat. Take a look at pictures of Yankee Stadium from the 1940s. People in the audience, jackets and hats. But so the issue is, though, today, though, hats are not part of the general culture. It's understood that you wear a hat, you're a yeshiva bacher. In fact, there's shmuzin that speak about what it means when you wear a jacket and hat. It puts you in a different category. It's a uniform. It's a uniform of the yeshiva bacher. But in the Musar yeshivas, they were not interested in uniforms of yeshiva bacherim. They're interested in uniforms of what's considered appropriate dress. It's not just for the yeshiva students. Thank you, MJ Frank, over at Pimer. You know, it also could be that in Europe they pronounce it Pimer, and in America they pronounce it Pimer. We have plenty of examples where names change when they came to America. And you heard David Rav Lichtenstein attribute the quote, not everything is taught to Rav Chaim. That I've never heard. It's hard to imagine. Yes, and Samuel remembers Rav Lessen walking head held high and not a speck of dust. Okay, that's... I forgot to mention, J.J. Kimchi is doing the other Torah in Motion media enterprise, the podcast of Jewish Ideas, where, I don't know if it's every other week, whatever it is, he gets top figures in the world of academic Jewish scholarship, and he speaks to them, interviews them, and it's a pleasure not just listening to them, listening to him. Because he has the great skill to be able to speak about Bible, Kabbalah, or whatever the issue is. And if you like English accents, that's also good. Okay, Moshe, about Rav Gifter and Rav Yaakov, I'm not going to mention it. And yes, okay. Okay, Dov says, recalled reading Rav Yaakov was going to join the Rav in Kollel in Boston. Yes, the Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and the Rav actually had a meeting about opening a yeshiva together in Boston. Not the Heichal Rav Chaim Halevi, either the one that he ended up opening. The Heichal Rav Chaim Halevi expanded into other things as well, or a new yeshiva, I don't remember. But then he ended up going to New York. That's correct. Okay, Moshe says he mentioned Dostoevsky. Okay, thank you all for coming out tonight. We have one more class before the Pesach break, and we'll try to continue till next week in Slabodka. That's where we all should be, in Slabodka, for the next week.
Okay, Rabbi Kelman. Yeah, by the way, next week you'll have a different login because we'll have our Pesach login because all the programs starting on Wednesday. Dr. Lindsay Guhart will kick it off Wednesday talking about Chaim Bahi Chatzilayla. You'll notice I send up the email every day at 1 o'clock till Pesach. We'll have a share, then a few other ones in addition to 1 p.m. And of course, this Sunday, a Yom Iyun, we'll have 9 speakers back to back, half an hour each, going through the Haggadah Shel Pesach beginning at 9:15. That promises to be a very good program. Really wonderful speakers. Sunday from 9:15 till 2 o'clock, going through from Kadesh to Shulchan Aruch. Okay, everybody. And, hope to see you soon learning. I put the registration, if you haven't registered, in the chat box, and Laila Tov, and be well, everybody. Thank you.
Good night.
Nisan bin Nisan Nigalu, and please God, the Atit should be in the Hoveh. And everybody be well. Laila Tov. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.